All right. Two quick announcements before Ira gets in talk. The first one is, there's always been an unwritten rule with the faculty that we don't talk at lectures, but we break it. And I know we have many things to say, but we really have made a written rule, not written, but a serious rule that the faculty is going to shut up during the lecture. This is your time. It's not about us hearing ourselves talk. It's about you. So that all the commenting in the lecture comes from the students, not from the faculty. The faculty is going to be absolutely pristinely quiet.
I won't even recognize it.
Believe it. We're really going to do it. And if not, a bolt of lightning is going to come and strike the person who's doing it. And the second thing is just a little thing about meals. Yesterday, he stopped serving at 6, and a couple of people were later. So I asked them to keep the food out until 6:15. Even on the schedule, it says it's 6:30. The chef wants to go home. So a couple of lectures go till 5:30, and those days just go straight to meals. And just remember that you shouldn't start taking the food back at around 6:15, okay? So get for dinner, get there sooner if you can. All right? That's it.
I feel like I should introduce myself. I'm Perry Como. This is the first time in all the talks I've given at graduate programs that I feel like I'd like to alter my title a little bit. And I want to talk about structure and poetic memory. They're very close to each other. They're not exactly the same, but I'm going to talk about the ways in which poetic memory defines structure. And here's the methodology I'd like to use. I'd like to go for like the first quarter of the lecture on my own with you following with the poems. And then I want to open up so we can enact some of the models I provided with a couple of the other poems. We're not going to get to all the poems on my list. If there's a term you don't understand, if there's something that doesn't make sense to you, I'm happy to clarify. But otherwise, I'd like to motor to make sure we get the work done. There'll be plenty of time there'll be some time for questions if you have them. And don't hesitate to interrupt if my diction, because every poet has a different critical vocabulary. So not all, I don't expect you to have absorbed mine yet. But those of you who are working with me, be careful. Okay, structure and poetic memory. Imagine if we could make every moment matter, if we could honor experience by attending to the richness and density life offers us. As Isaiah says in Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. Heightened consciousness, the art of paying attention, enriches and humanizes us. It helps us monitor our choices, gives us the opportunity to avoid endlessly repeating the same mistakes. As we attend to what gives others pleasure and what causes pain, consciousness engenders compassion and a penchant for justice. Imagine, too, life with less inattentiveness, boredom, time-wasting, stasis, less sloth, with fewer routinized or alienated, mind-numbing tasks that wear away the soul. I know I wish for more concentration, a capacity, either by an assertion of will or by a release of it, to experience life with greater intensity. Certain sects of Buddhists call this concentration mindfulness. It's also the religion of ecstatics. For our purposes, I'd say that an embodied consciousness is also the religion of poetry. Given the complexity of modern life with its multitasking, its stresses and distractions, the state may be impossible to achieve in our daily lives. But poetry not only gives us the opportunity, but the obligation to aspire to this attentiveness, this cleansing of perception, this purifying, articulate precision. For it is a poet's job to shape experience, to make every word matter, to excise the peripheral or irrelevant, the boring and the cliched, experience reduced to the generalized and the familiar, to intensify and transform an originating impulse so that all the craft elements in the poem create a single effect, an imaginative experience. To move a reader, a poet sculpts this impulse, advances, complicates, questions, discovers, deletes, but never loses sight of the poem's probe. When all the craft vehicles perform in the service of that impulse, the heart of the poem, that's what gives a poem structure. Revision's one of the most vexing and rewarding struggles for a poet. Poets who's starting out are often at a loss for how to improve or not mess up their first drafts, what they feel inspired the poem in the first place. Often we polish a poem rather than revise it. We try to make it sound good. We put in some alliteration. We might break the lines in more interesting places. We might take out offending cliches. That's microcosmic work, more akin to decorating a room than performing the macrocosmic framing of a poem, which is attending to how the vitality of the language contributes to that effect. That's why structure is sometimes called architecture. What good is a well-decorated room when the foundation's falling apart? What good is a poem that sounds good but leaves the reader with such diffuse clues he or she loses faith in the authority of the poet? Revision is exactly as it sounds. It's re-seeing the world of the poem. It turns a diffuse experience into one that, simply put, matters. Poets don't have the luxury of novelists, writing lines that merely descriptively set a mood or tone, or create merely decorative surfaces or description that sound pleasing to the ear. Poetry is not some character study that merely describes an interesting person you've met. Poetry doesn't have time for transitional writing, narrative information that gets a poem from one place to another, but has no intrinsic interest in the lines themselves. Poetry requires everything that a good crash-and-burn love affair requires. Every gesture, every suggestion matters. If your lover likes French fries, or an expression appears on his or her face that suggests worry or peevishness, you're at your peril if you ignore it. You don't project onto that lover any more than you will a poem subject. You ask questions. You ask the poem, lover, questions that grow out of the history of what you've already seen and heard, in the lines or in the life. Poems require a very specific kind of memory, not the dime store memories of what once happened to you, but syntactical memories, the emotional weight of the poem as it accrues from line to line. Poetry is not dissociative, separating craft from art. It's associative. It follows the inexorable logic of the way we think and feel and what we notice, where the poem's camera focuses. It doesn't proceed by fact or chronos or reason. That's where improvisation and form intersect. You remember how something you saw or heard in line one stays with you, and what you say in line 16 responds to what's preceded it. As in a jazz group, when a trumpeter is about to solo, he or she hears what the tenor's already said about that melody, and his or her solo grows out of that listening. And you do the same thing with your poems, which is to listen, to pay attention to where the poem is taking you, to be responsible to the words that have already accrued there in their emotional suggestion and in their craft. Okay. You don't attend to the experience by repeating, in other words, what's already been said, but you do respond to it. So you don't gloss your own lines. You don't accomplish with a piece of rhetoric what the drama of the poem should have already done. You take it someplace new. I think of structure then as the dramatic, lived, observed, inhabited connections among all the craft elements, image, metaphor, diction, syntax, line, music, and the unifying force, the conflict, the obsession of the poem, the poetic argument. The poet's working through the urgency of what happened, narrative, or how it feels, or what it feels like, lyric, in motion, how it changes our experience of ourselves and our relationship to the world. Here are some dangers. We're not talking about theme, intellectual abstractions of feelings, such as, this is a poem about mortality. If someone says that to me, I'm thinking, okay, who's mortality? What do you know about mortality? What's the experience that's being lived in this poem? Here's a poem about loneliness. When were you lonely? Why were you lonely? When were you not lonely? You ask questions of a poem that go deeper than the generalizing unifying idea. If you're already locked in your head, you've forgotten where those feelings came from, and it's much harder to communicate that to others. Okay, we're not talking about narrative event, a car crash, loss of innocence. And we're not talking about description, a rumpled fender, or even plot, the bastard ran a light because he was drunk. If your poem is well structured, you develop powerful motive for detail selection, which is the dramatic evidence of the poem. The progress of narratives, how they advance the speaker's feeling about that conflict. The images will echo, reinforce, or argue with one another. I'm not talking about a system of images, symbolism, since images work by association, a set of correspondences. So if you want to make a poem work in the 20th century, Mike, a rose might have meant in the Renaissance passion, or white might have meant purity. But a rose means a whole bunch of different things to us, depending where the rose is. And white isn't only purity, as many of us know who are white. Right? It's far from purity, right? Okay. So, I'm going to start to get more specific. When Garcia Lorca, speaker, says, as the moon rises, the heart is like an island in infinity. Every moment in that poem must intensify that simile's effect. What is the poem about? Well, look and listen. The heart is like an island in infinity. These are images of scope and size. They're images of awe. They're images of isolation. It's not just one thing. It's a locus of feelings. And that gives poetry its density, just like no experience ever means one thing. Okay, I want to take you back to what to that Blake comment that I made. If we could see everything with the lenses of perception were clear, we would see the infinite suggestion of things. And as the poem does its work, the more of the prismatic it affects of the things that it sees, the richer, the more difficult it is to articulate it as an idea, then the poem is lived. Because when you see that heart as an island in infinity, you have to see it, you have to feel it, you know what it looks like in space before you can articulate anything about it. I was able to articulate this feeling about it not only by the image in its isolated place, but by the other elements in the poem that brought me there, that create the structure, right? So, how do we know the speaker feels isolated or dislocated? Very first stanza, impenetrable footpaths appear. He's lost. That helps us understand why the heart would feel like an island in infinity. And these lines set a scene for both mystery and being lost. What does the darkness bring? Well, we know we can't eat oranges under the full moon. A surrealist image that a surrealist command that makes no sense until we realize we're talking about the moon and we're thinking about the sun. We're thinking about orange as a warm color. We're thinking of orange as the same shape as the moon. Instead, we have to eat fruit that is green and cold, an apple, a pear. And the difference between eating something that's cold, the chill that comes with night, with darkness, with dusk, the warmth, the passion, the light that comes with an orange, that's not available to us as that moon rises. So by the end of the poem, we are so moved, both by awe, by longing, by our smallness in shape and size, that the silver coins sob in the pockets. Now, the poem has earned its surrealism early with the oranges and with the impenetrable footpaths appearing, just as in Kafka, you know, he's a dung beetle from the time you open the door. He doesn't become a dung beetle at the end. It's not like a Freddy Krueger movie, you know, where he comes out of a closet. We didn't know he was in the closet. Well, you knew Kafka was a bug, right from the very beginning. And you knew from those impenetrable footpaths that the speaker is lost and looking for some emotional truth. So what's the coldest thing in the world? Colder than fruit that's green and cold. Colder than the moon. Money. And the power of the moon is so strong that the coldest, most inanimate, same shape as orange, as the moon, the silver coins, they sob in the pocket. Nobody can escape the awe and the loneliness, the sense of how small we are in the universe. Not even in our dream life can the silver coins in the pocket. So if you think of this as a symphony, you're thinking that at the very end of the symphony, we have the intensification of what every moment in the poem has brought us to. There's nothing more intense than this. There's nothing as fulfilling as this. There's nothing as powerful as this. But Lorca has never forgotten that the speaker in this poem is lost and small and in awe of a universe that's not fathomable, nor is it his. And when you read this poem the first time, you don't have those ideas. Thank God. What you get is you get your butt kicked. But that's the reader's response to a writer who knows how to orchestrate design, who's responsible for every word that he or she writes. That it's the job of the writer not to create a design of ideas, but to sculpt and to shape. So it's an artist's job. You're shaping experience. And what he's doing is taking out everything that has nothing to do with this emotional life. No matter how great it sounded, no matter how good it looked, you know, he was really hot when he wrote this line. Doesn't matter. He's not going to give you anything that you don't need to make this experience matter. And he knows in some emotional way, and I'm talking about a spine that's emotional. I'm not talking about a spine that's an idea. Poems have ideas in them, but they're embodied. That's why I said a heightened consciousness is an embodied consciousness, so that you understand the ways in which the craft of the poem works in the service of those feelings. So the more you have on your palette as a painter, all those craft vehicles, syntax, image, line, that gives you the more power to extend the ways in which you can fulfill that experience. Some poets break their lines by breath. What lost opportunities that is. Some poets never change the syntax the order of their words. What missed opportunities to reinforce feeling. Some people tell narrative poems from moment one to moment two, always in the present tense. What lost opportunities? How do we put life together? Flashbacks. Projections, fantasies, longings, dreams. All of those things are available to you as a way of creating and filling out what the questions of the poem ask. And you know, you can only do this if you let the poem ask questions. You can't do it by starting with an idea about what you want to say, because then you're not listening. Then think of that love poem correspondence again. You go into a relationship. These are the qualities I want in my lover, X, Y, Z. And, oh, God, they don't have that. I can't possibly love them. You're not going to learn much from other people any more than you're going to learn anything from the poem if you can't listen. And listening, that attentiveness, is what I think is at the heart of a capacity to revise. Where are the moments in a poem that matter, that must be responded to, that must be advanced to intensify that experience? Okay, I'm going to do one more and then we'll do some together. Charlie Simic's, I want to do Charlie Simic's poem, which seems like a very simple poem. Charlie Simic's poems are always deceptively complicated. This is called The Partial Explanation. And start looking for these things in poems, right? Okay. Seems like a long time since the waiter took my order. Grimy little luncheonette, the snow falling outside. Seems like it has grown darker since I last heard the kitchen door behind my back, since I last noticed anyone pass on the street. A glass of ice water keeps me company. At this table I chose myself upon entering, and a longing, incredible longing, to eavesdrop on the conversations of cooks. So it doesn't seem like a lot to ask. That's it. I want to start by focusing on an emotional moment that strikes me to be at the heart of the poem that the rest of the poem lives up to. And other people have different locuses, loci. We say loci, locos. You'll have different locos. You'll have different locos. Okay. My Spanish isn't that good. But. A glass of ice water keeps me company. Yummy. I chose three or four poems that are all working around the constellation of loneliness. What does that speak to? Grimy little luncheonette. The snow falling outside. It's cold outside. It's cold inside. Seems like a long time since anybody passed on the street. A glass of ice water keeps me company. Seems like a long time. Time is important. Seems like a long time. This is one repetition that's not comforting. Because longer and longer he waits, the more and more convinced he is of his own isolation. Nobody's paying him any attention. He doesn't even want someone to come down and talk to him. But behind the closed doors of the kitchen, he wants to hear the conversation of the cooks. Any human presence would be an improvement. It's a longing. It's an incredible longing. Like, incredible. It's not believable that he would want something like this. Low expectations. Syntax. This table I chose myself upon entering. Maybe if he entered again, he wouldn't choose that table himself. Maybe he would not choose himself at this table. The partial explanation lets us know we're in the metaphysical luncheonette. We're in a luncheonette that's a real luncheonette. It has the narrative backdrop. But we're also in Jean-Paul Sartre's luncheonette. Right? And those conversations of cooks that can't be heard might very well be those people who have designs, who have control. He has no clue as to why he's experiencing not loneliness, but aloneness, as Sartre says in Existentialism as a Humanist. So everything in this poem, the syntax of this this table he chose himself upon entering, the imagery of the snow falling outside and the ice water, the coldness, the lack of voices, and the music. Seems like a long time since the waiter took my order from Brooklyn. But it helps me get those A's and those O's. Time is expanding in the music as well, right? The music's not just there for a tap dance. It's not just there to show off how you can clank sounds together. The music is there to reinforce that emotional moment of the expansion of time where one feels one's own self in the universe. And once again, in this very simple narrative poem, Lorca's poem is really a lyric poem with some narrative elements about feeling. But in the narrative poem, it tells a story. But it's not the story you'd think would be interesting, is it? He's telling this story. I went to a luncheonette, and it took a long time before the waiter would take my order. Big effing deal, huh? Right? That's what makes it so amazing in some ways, which is, here it is, daily life seen infinitely. Seen with the emotional and metaphysical suggestion. So your emotional camera is doing the work at every moment in a poem to figure out where do you place your poetic eye that will bring the reader to the largest, fullest feeling that you can manage in a poem. This also works with complicated postmodern poems. The closures are different because the ideas in postmodern poems are not to conclude about experience. And, I think the best poems ask questions more than they deliver answers anyway. But here are two very different kinds of poems on the same subject that provide by their structure, by their poetic attention, by watching and by listening and by using all the craft vehicles to concentrate and intensify that experience. And you'll notice in the closure of Simic's poem, the emotional life is enlarged. This is the first time you have him expressing any emotion at all. A longing. An incredible longing. Now, a lesser poet would have turned this into a self-pitying line, "I am feeling so lonely." And then we wouldn't get the particularity of all somewhat the aspiration. The poem does the work of, the aspiration is just to hear a human voice. To feel more human. By the end of this experience, the poet, the speaker, feels less human. Okay. I want to do a Billie Holiday song. And I thought about, and maybe if we have a second, I thought about, I have the version with me, and nobody can read a Billie Holiday song like she can sing it. But I did this because it's a persona poem. And you can do it, and a really well-structured song will have exactly those same conditions. What I'd like you to listen to, and then we can talk about it, are the transformations and the constancies. What's the emotional probe of the poem? And what changes in the speaker to keep us going? So we learn more and more, and so the speaker learns more and more about how she feels. Right? Okay. There's actually four. There should be four stanzas, and it's Good Morning Heartache will start the last stanza as well. Good morning, heartache, you old gloomy sight. Good morning, heartache, thought we said goodbye last night. I tossed and turned until it seemed you had gone. But here you are with the dawn. Wish I forget you, but you're here to stay. It seems I met you when my love went away. Now every day I start, I'm saying to you, good morning, heartache. What's new? Stop haunting me now. Can't chase you no how. Just leave me alone. I've got those Monday blues straight through Sunday blues. Good morning, heartache. Here we go again. Good morning, heartache. You're the one who knew me when. Might as well get used to you hanging round. Good morning, heartache. Sit down. Excuse me. I still have her voice, and I wish I had my voice in my voice and you could hear me, but I can't sing or shit. So. I embarrass myself. I know. So let's look at the emotional attitudes of the poem. We're dealing with heartache. It's a persona poem. The heartache is a personification of the displacement of her lost love. She's lost her love. Seems like she met you when her love went away. So she's wrestling. She's wrestling with heartache, with loss, right? So everything in the poem is about that wrestling match, about coming to terms with it. Acceptance, resignation, resistance, rage, hurt, weakness. It's all there. And the closure of the poem brings us to a new place, but one that comes as a result of everything that precedes it. The poetic memory. Okay, so let's talk about it a little bit. If we look at that first stanza, good morning, heartache, you old gloomy sight. Good morning, heartache. Thought we said goodbye last night. I tossed and turned until it seemed you had gone, but here you are with the dawn. So, what do we know about a relationship to heartache from this stanza?
Perhaps she didn't realize how much she was involved in the relationship and how much she cared.
Right. She thought she could expel it.
Yeah.
Right? You know, just by tossing and turning, just by, you know, lose it in your dream life. You know? But here you are.
I also like the fact that, obviously, from the first line, good morning, heartache, you know it's because of, she had this because of a breakup. And when it said, it was the line, thought we said goodbye last night, she's trying to break up with heartache.
Right. Exactly.
And I thought that was so, that was really cool.
That's what that personification does.
It's trying to break up with heartache, but it's here to stay.
And it's unlike the lover who is gone.
Right.
Right? And so it's what you're left with when your lover goes. And so how do you get out of it? How do you not stay stuck? I thought you'd gone. And then, but here you are with the dawn. Now the meter changes from, I thought you were, I don't want to get this right. I tossed and turned until it seemed you had gone. But here you are with the dawn. Gone and dawn and off rhyme. Things are not right. The off rhyme indicates it's almost like moving from a major to a minor key. And so the music is cueing us to a shift in the emotional life of the poem. Right? So, end of first stanza, we don't know how she feels about it, except she thought she got rid of him, and here he is, with the dawn, when she first wakes up. Yeah, he's with her all day. All day, all night, hearted. Okay, so now she's got to wrestle with it. If this poem could end here, it would be static. Yeah, and there is a politeness to it that is a mode of attempting to accept, and that foreshadows what's going to happen. And you can see the falseness of the politeness, I think, by the ways in which the rhymes don't work, or the ways in which we have two beat lines or three beat lines mixed with five beat lines. So, yeah, okay, so let's see where she goes next. Where's she going to go? He's still here? She's still got a problem. That's why we have a poem. She has a problem. If the problem's solved, it's no poem. It's an idea. It's a journal entry. Wish I'd forget you, but you're here to stay. It seems like I met you when my love went away. Now, every day I start, I'm saying to you, good morning, heartache. What's new? We got some mastery. I'm going to be friends with Artie. Yeah? If you're going to be here, if you're going to be here instead of my mother, tell me what's up. What's up with you, Artie? It's coming. It's playful. It's ironic. It's attempting to mute by irony, which is the defense against pain. You know that the poem can't settle here. Because then it wouldn't be heartache. It would be something smaller. If you could live with heartache, life would be a lot easier. You don't get to control it. And so one of the things that you can look backward and forward in this poem is the attempt to master and submit to the power of heartache. And that's once again part of the spine of this poem, right? Listen to what happens to begin stanza 3. Stop haunting me now. The line that's before it is, good morning, heartache, what's new? There's a radical change. Get out of my life. Get out of here. I can't live with this facade that I can accommodate my life to heartache. Can't chase you, no how. And the range is there in stop haunting me now. Lots of beats. We move from less, more passive verbs, but here you are with the dawn, where there's a slackness to it, a softness to it. And this is a command. It's an imperative. Can't chase you, no how. Just leave me alone. Hear the rage? It's as if the poem discovers its magic by breaking with its expectations. We're no longer, we've changed, there's a transformation. That's the piece of magic in the poem, that's the glass of ice water in Simic's poem, that is the heart and it's an island in infinity in Lorca's poem. It's the moment when the poem expands beyond the control of the writer. That's the magic. If you weren't paying attention, you might be able to master heartache if you willfully wanted to be celebratory. But we can see through stanzas 1 and 2. Those defenses aren't going to be enough. So she's digging deep. And that's one of the things structure asks of you. Not to settle for the easy, for the thematic, for the convention. And her rage at this moment allows her to make the next meditative moment of the poem, which is, I've got those Monday blues. And everyone's got Monday blues, right? You go to work, you got Monday blues. Straight through Sunday blues. Despair. So by expressing the rage fully, she can express the pain fully. There's nowhere to go from this. Except, here we go again. Good morning, Harnack. You're the one who knew me when. You're the change.
You're the one who knew me when. You can hear the regularity of the meter. We can believe this. You're the one who knew me when. What's the change? Now she's really pissed off at the beginning of the chapter 3. Yeah. And what's that acceptance based on?
Familiarity.
A history. There's a history between them. And what gets her there? Sunday through Monday. Time. And then, in the closure of the poem, we can get to good morning, Harvey. Sit down. And if you hear the word Billie Holiday interprets these lines, it's a command again. And it's a command, which is, you're the only thing I know. You might as well be comfortable because we're going to be there all the time. And she wouldn't have known it in the beginning of the poem.
So she wrote.
Now, it's her interpretation of the words. It's written by Isabel Higginbotham. Another African American writer.
I think it's Isabel is her first name. But I'm working on her interpretation of this poem, the way in which she hears it. There are other people who've done this tunes, Perry Como kinds of people, and they don't get it. I want to see if I can find. I want to find that for you. Irene Higginbotham, I'm sorry. So Irene knows heartache too. But Billy knows how it matters and why it matters. And you can hear it in the pacing of the poem. So we've had a lyric poem and a narrative poem and a persona poem. All of which meet the same requirements of having the spine of a poem, an emotion, and a heart of the poem in which all the craft elements of the poem move us toward the inexorable feeling and intensification of the poem. So I don't have much time. I knew I wouldn't have much time. Let's get a start on Larry Levison. Let's really do this together. I wanted you to see a poem where the poet is working with flashback and extended metaphor and narrative, where all the lyric and narrative elements come together. And what I first like to ask of you about this poem is what you think is at the emotional heart of the poem. And recognizing what's at the heart of the poem is going to be the key to your revision, which is what's the inquiry? What's the obsession? What's the worry? What's being worked out? And in a really good poem, what's being worked out may be obliquely worked out. It may be worked out with lots of variation in it. It may walk away the way in which a dream might appear in the middle of the poem, and its relationship at one moment may seem peripheral to that, but it's all going to illuminate that probe. So you'll notice there's a flashback in this poem. You'll notice there's a central metaphor about seeing what a wall of flame looks like in a steel mill. And you'll see him in the present tense in the narrative. And you'll see the weather. You'll see about spring and winter. And you want to look at that verb, that great verb, dislodge. Okay, so I'm going to read it and ask you what you think is at the heart of the poem, and then we can look at how these things bring the poem together. That's what your revision process is going to look like. It's going to work through making sure that every moment contributes to the inquiry of the poem, to the probe of the poem. Not only contributes, but advances. It advances. It transforms. Poems get transformed. Otherwise, if we know what the poem is about in line 3 or line 4, every line after that is disappointing. If you don't take a poem beyond its premise, there's no reason for us to continue reading it. The poem is solved. And then you're just drawing pictures to show what happens now that it's solved. And nothing's at stake. It's like killing off your main character in page 3 of a story, which is what we all did on our first story, right? Because we hated that character so much. And then he died, you know. That'll show him. But, you know, he's not feeling any pain. What does he care? Okay. I'm going to read this wonderful poem by Larry Levis. And let's see what we can do with it. Except under the cool shadows of pines, the snow is already thawing along this road. Such sun and wind. I think my father longed to disappear while driving through this place once in 1957. Beside him, my mother slept in a gray dress while his thoughts moved like the shadow of a cloud over houses. And he was seized suddenly by his own shyness, by his desire to be grass and simplified. Was it brought on by the road or the snow or the sky with nothing in it? He kept sweating and wiping his face until it passed, and I never knew. But in the long journey away from my father, I took only his silences, his indifference to misfortune, rain, stones, music, and grief. Now, I can sleep beside this road if I have to. Even while the stars are pale and go out, and it is day. And I can keep secrets for years, the way a stone retains warmth from the sun. It is because men like us own nothing, really. I remember once, in the steel mill where I worked, someone opened the door of the furnace, and I glanced in at the simple, quick, and blank erasures the flames made of iron, of everything on earth. It was reverence I felt then, and did not know why. I do not even know why my father lived out his one life farming 200 acres of gray malaga vines and peach trees twisted by winter. They lived, I think, because his hatred of them was entire and wordless. I still think of him staring into this road 20 years ago, while his hands gripped the wheel harder, and his wish to be no one made his body tremble, like the touch of a woman he could not see, her fingers drifting up his spine in silence until his loneliness was perfect, and she let him go. Her laughter turning into these sheets of black and glassy ice that dislodge themselves and ride slowly out over the thawing river. That's good. That's awfully good.
What's the speaker worried about?
He can turn to his father?
Yeah. And what do we know about his father?
Cold dude.
That's right. And we got that black and glassy ice, huh? Not only cold, what else is it?
He never lived his life.
Yeah.
He did what he wanted to do.
He was overwhelmed by the mechanical quality of the labor that he put in farming those gray Malaga grapes. And if you know a little bit about grapes, Malaga grapes are the kind that used to, Gallo wouldn't even buy them. No, you have to be like under 18 to drink it. Right? Okay. And here's a teacher's question, the kind I don't like to ask because, you know, teachers' questions are the ones they already know the answer to. Right? So, is there gray anywhere else in this phone?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like we got the gray drafts, right? And we got the black ice, and we got the white snow, so this gray thing is like really colorless. I'll spare you the stupid question, or the most stupid question, something I didn't spare you. So he's wrestling with not wanting to be like his father. How does he get there? How does he get there and be like his father? What's the ultimate fear of being like his father? It's very particular.
He says it's fine, and if I can keep secrets for years,
yes,
you know, like this idea of not actually sharing what it is you're thinking and feeling with other people who
right.
care about you and depend on you.
The loneliness is perfective.
I think it's complicated. I think he's glad his father stayed with his family rather than just coming out and leaving.
Why do you think that?
I just got it from the feeling of the poem.
I don't know.
I think he's, in a way, he admires his father, but he doesn't want to be like him.
But I think what he admires about his father is that his father, it's the shared longing that they have. It's not a healthy longing. It's the desire to be simplified and to be grasped, right? And the other image we have of being simplified is when that harness opens and they're eradicated.
When he says it was reverence I felt then and did not know why, you know, I'm not sure he was happy with the feeling that he felt that reverence.
Right.
I think it frightened him.
It's a reverence for death.
The idea of erasure was this thing.
And the father can't accept the mother's touch. So being like his father, he doesn't fully understand it. But there's a death wish in this poem.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of thaw that we ordinarily might think of as warmth, you know, spring, the convention, things are finally warming up. But the coldness is better because once you acknowledge that feeling, you want to die. Because you're not going to be back with human company. You're going up the river by this lodge. That's, I mean, if I had one clue to offer you, it would be verbs. Verbs communicate relationships, and they're the actions of home. It's what happens. And the eccentricity of the verb, this lodge, it's almost mechanical. It's not an emotionally charged piece of diction. And because the more dramatic the feeling is, the more controlled that impulse has to be. And we have knowledge that the speaker does not have. I don't know why art is repeated two or three different times in this poem. He doesn't know why his father felt the way he did, why he was like the shadow of a cloud. The similes in this poem are amazing because they all have emotional weight. They are connected to the sky, to weather. They're connected to an unearthliness about them. There's nothing rooted in the father. He could sleep under the stars. Ordinarily, that might be romantic. He's not with anybody. He could keep a secret for years. He's alone. So he gets to see his father being alone in reflection and flashback. But that's his life. Who's in the car with him? Nobody. So the power of this poem in part is as it unfolds by narrative, by the story, by the plot, by the use of a flashback, by that central metaphor, by the detailed selection of the images, which are connected to weather, but all of those weather things, except under the chill of these trees, everything is fine, and it's in the darkness, in the clouds, that he
is able to feel the loneliness of his father. Because our memories are triggered by events. Memories just don't occur. They're occurred, this is my circumstance. I'm driving along a road and my parents once drove this road. You wouldn't necessarily think that if there wasn't an emotional association between the moment in the present and the moment in the past. And uncovering that is the dream work of the poem. The structure of the poem then is, why is it that my father and I want to die? Why is it that I want to be alone? Why is it that I seem to have no vitality? Can you say something else? Sorry.
Yeah, I want to ask you, I'm reading you right, you're saying there's no sense of hope at the end of this poem, right?
That's my reading of it. But her laughter turns into these sheets of ice. You got to remember where those lines start, right?
Right.
And they start with her laughter that he cannot hear.
Well, it just seems that, you know, to touch back on the, if the title's about this, the wall of fire and the steel mill, right? Because there's just so much, this sort of sense imagery of hot and cold.
Right.
You know, so we start with this sense of thawing. So the cold is going away at the very beginning point. So we're starting with this idea, and although we go through these cycles of cold and hot, and if the father maybe is just incapable of relationship with wife, kids, whatever it is, because the speaker says, and you ask the question about, what's he afraid of? Well, maybe he's not afraid of being like his father. He's sort of acknowledged it. I mean, he's already acknowledged that he is.
Right.
So maybe a sense of just accepting that fact, at least, on some level.
I would just say one thing, and I don't need to insist on my view of the poem, and that's fine too. I would just say that what the image of that furnace is, it's not only eradication, it's also an image of heat. And while we might think of heat and warmth ordinarily as images that are comforting, emotionally available, all of those things, what they are here are death. The only way we know how to feel about the end of the poem is the historical memory of the poem and the associations with it. And my reading of those associations is that this heat is a furnace that destroys, that eats away, that eradicates, that turns a man to nothing, that his life is nothing. The life he has as a farmer, farming those grapes, is nothing. And so it's erasure. Isn't that the word he uses, that it's erasure? Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. From it. It doesn't end with the speaker. We don't know what's going to happen with the speaker. But, in fact, he walks away from his own emotional life and ends it in the flashback.
Yeah.
In a sense, yeah.
It's interesting that this idea of nothingness, he continues throughout the poem. He uses the word nothing, whether brought on by the road or the snow or the sky with nothing in it, and his wish to be no one. I do not even know why my father. Oh, nothing really. This idea of nothingness. And at the same time, he's on this road of nothingness,
right.
And he plants those all the way through it. And if you follow your idea of the heat erasing things, he starts out. There's the thawing. Usually the snow is already thawing. It's an idea of spring and resurrection and new life.
And that's the irony of the poem. And that's the irony of the poem.
The thawing is very dangerous. And he's out onto the thawing.
Black ice, about black ice is extremely dangerous. That's when people get in accidents. I just want to say one thing about one of the things about the imagination of this poem, and I don't want to thematize the poem too much. I want to stay with the fact that this is a made thing that's shaped by a feeling. But one of the powers of this poem is to not use traditional, not to rely on symbolic language. It's spring, it's a time of renewal. Right? We're cued for that. And so the ways in which the poem transforms our expectations is one of the ways in which spring for this speaker sucks. It's not a time of hope. It's a time that reminds them not of the future, but of the past. Okay, David, and then I think we should have gone. Do I only have an hour? What is it?
We have an hour, but we have a, you know.
No, I can go on forever. Let's do about 12 more times. I'm ready.
I'm drawn to this line toward the end that says, they lived, I think, because his hatred of them was entire and wordless.
Yeah.
And throwing that and wordless in, I was kind of hung up on. And then I realized, I guess he's talking about his father's silence, his reticence, and his inability to explain things. And then I went back and I noticed that so many of the images are silent images,
right,
like the pines with the snow thawing and the shadow of the clouds.
They're not even the things themselves, they're the echo effect.
Right. And the silence there, even at the end, is interesting. But then I was drawn to the fire, which maybe you could almost hear a little bit, the one image. And it's his image, but...
There's no hearing in his presentation of the image, though.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't get that sound. What you get is that visual image. And the way in which those lines are good lines of poetry is that it doesn't end with his hatred of them was entire. What's important about it and doesn't make it predictable is that it doesn't end with a statement. It ends with wordlessness, which is what has made his father a mystery. That his father never communicated in words what he felt. And he can keep secrets for years. And so it's the wordlessness that they share in common, that kind of self-encapsulation that gives them both a faded and resigned and bitter sense of time passing. And nobody's there. Even when his wife was there, she wasn't there. Even in that gesture of moving up his spine, a touching, caressing your spouse, what a romantic image that should be, but it's moving up the spine. It's almost like an insect. And that's done by the suggestion of the imagery. Right? Everything in this poem, a poem that goes on for 40 lines or so, everything in this poem advances because of its poetic memory. The structure of the poem, what it's after. It complicates it, it moves away from it. Here's you know how, if you listen to our stories that we tell our friends, they don't go in a straight line necessarily. Sometimes they do, but the stories are often served by knowing what happened once earlier. Who are we? We are, in some way, collections of our flashbacks. You know, the ways in which time is not all synchronicity. It's compounded. And so that's something you have available to you. But you got to make sure, if you're going to use a flashback, that it advances what we already know. That it doesn't just give a second example, a third example, a fourth example, until your reader feels like, okay, I get it. Right? The poem moves toward intensification. Okay. Since Jerry's not here, I'm not going to do this poem that much. But I sent him a copy of it. Or maybe he will feel really bad after the reading. I don't know. You tell me, so I'll know whether I should sit near him. Thank you very much.